you people should now know a good deal more about Jewish law than I knew 3 years ago before I decided to add it to the course. And I thought, although I've got various things I could say, since you've already read a good deal of what I have to say, I thought I would start by trying to see if there were things that struck you reading it that you either didn't understand or wanted to comment on or had ideas about or anything of that sort. So let me start by handing it over to you people and see what you have to say about Jewish law. Yeah.
So what accounts for the breakdown of the authority of the Sanhedrin? You claim that they were particularly useful or recognized up until about 350. What happened then?
I don't know. There's one point, but I think it's earlier than that, at which it looks as though the Romans are trying to forcibly prevent the sort of equivalent of apostolic succession. There's at least one of the sages who, if I've got it correct, gets martyred in the process of doing whatever he has to do to appoint other people as sages or whatever the technical term is. So there, 358, there's still the Roman Empire is still a going concern, although it's sort of on its way down.
Well, it's not become Christian. I mean, it's close
yeah.
to Constantine declares Christianity.
Yes. Yes. I don't know if that affects it. I think the Romans were concerned a good deal earlier, because after all, there's a big revolt, which takes them a good deal of trouble to suppress in 100 and something. But the impression one gets is that by the time the Sanhedrin goes, certainly the kingdom of Israel is long ago history, and an awful lot of the Jews are dispersed about the Mediterranean world, which makes it in a sense harder to function. But I really don't know enough about how actively the Romans were trying to suppress it. That would be worth trying to follow up. And it's also not clear to me sort of how much authority the Sanhedrin had. I don't think they'd made very many decisions in the last period, and so it may be that it was really sort of apostle in a sense. I don't know. But at least what the sources seem to say is the authority then shifts to the Babylonian academies. That there's the Babylonian exile, which I guess established a Jewish population outside of Israel early on. And as you may know, because I made clear, the Talmud, there are two versions of the Talmud, of which the more important one is from Babylonia and the less important one is from Jerusalem. So presumably the Babylonian academies were sort of the center of academic work on Jewish law during the later period. And I gathered, I don't think I discussed it there, but I get different dates for when the Gion and when the Babylonian academies lose their authority. It sounds as though they may have kept their authority later in the Islamic part than in the Christian part of the diaspora. It really is quite a long and complicated and elaborate story. I mean, that chapter ends up being longer than most of the other chapters, and I still feel that there's all sorts of stuff I've left out that would be worth discussing. It's also, as you can see, a little bit fragmentary, and then I sort of tell the story and then say, well, here's the stuff I haven't told you about that's interesting, and tell some more of the story. What happens in modern American law if you steal something from me and then sell it to her, and I then discover the fact? Any of you know?
You're a bona fide purchaser.
You're a bona fide purchaser. You had no way of knowing it was stolen. Sorry. What who ends up with the thing?
One of us ends up with money.
Except that the thief may not have money. So it matters a good... What?
The bona fide purchaser ends up with the property.
And does the bona fide purchaser and owe anything to the legitimate owner? I had thought that the old rule in English common law was market ouvert, which was that if you sold it in a public market in daylight, that gave good title. But that other forms of transaction didn't. And I assume the theory of that was that
that's still carried out. So if you buy it from a reputable merchant, then the UCC applies.
So and what is the rule? Even if it's stolen property, what right do I, the original owner, have either against the thief or against the bona fide purchaser? Well, as I say, I think you can, or at least could, in England if it was sold in a public market in daylight. I just find one of the things that I found sort of fun reading Maimonides was to what extent he's dealing with issues we still have. That, you know, it's it in a sense feels more like a modern legal system than a lot of the other ones we're looking at, even though it's got no, I suppose it's got a little bit of a link to Roman law and could have been influenced by Roman law, but it's really its own system going back to before Roman law existed, and long, long before English common law existed. And yet, it ends up, in many cases, sort of paralleling or having slightly different solutions to the same problem. Because the answer in Jewish law, let me see if I've got it, I think I have some notes on it, if I remember correctly how they do it, but the standard answer to that question is that the owner gets the property, but the owner must compensate the buyer and sue the thief. Seems somewhat odd solution that the property itself still belongs to the owner, but for whatever reason, since I'm taking the property you bought, I've got to give you the money you paid for it, and then it's up to me to sue the thief and try to get that money back. And that sort of is the default rule. But then there are a couple of other special cases. One of them, which is related to what you were saying, is that if the thief was a notorious thief, if there was reason why the buyer should have suspected it was stolen, then you get a different rule. And then, let me see where I have that in here somewhere. Just looking at it. And then if the thief was... where is this? If the thief was notorious... then the owner gets it, and it's up to the buyer to sell the thief, to sue the thief, right? So if the thief is not notorious, and thus you were, as it were, a good faith buyer, then I get the property, would have to compensate you. If the thief was notorious, then I get the property, and the buyer has to sue the thief for his money back. And if the owner had abandoned hope, this is something which I don't know of any corresponding thing in this, but sort of if the owner had clearly treated it, not sure how you determine this, as something you would never get back, then the buyer ends up getting title. If the thief is not notorious, and if the thief is notorious, the buyer gets the title, but he has to pay the owner the value of the object. So I guess somehow you can see in a sense that the distinction between the object and its value becomes less and less important over time. You know, if it's my car and I haven't replaced it, well, I really want that car back. And, whereas if it were my horse, better. Whereas if, you know, if it got stolen 5 years ago, I long ago gave up on it, well, I sort of like my money. But all of that struck me interesting. There's also a bit which I didn't mention in the chapter, where I thought was rather funny in Maimonides, where Maimonides says basically that if something has been stolen by a Jewish highway robber, you give up hope of getting it. But if it's been stolen by a Gentile highway robber, then you haven't given up hope of getting it. I'm not sure it's in the same cast or somewhere else. Why is that? Because we know that the Gentile courts will convict you on very little evidence. And therefore, if the Gentile highway robbery has stolen it, you've got a reasonable chance of getting it back, whereas the Jewish courts have higher standards of evidence, and therefore, if a Jewish highway robber has stolen it, you won't. There are a lot of other weird stuff. Oh, yes, where is it? I'm trying to remember. There are a bunch of bits of Maimonides, and often if you just take, quote, one thing, it's a little bit misleading. Yeah?
Are you supposed to ask, well, they're robbing you, or, like, how do you...
Who knows? You must put this question to Maimonides, since he has been dead for 800 years. That's going to be difficult. But, yeah.
Based on the previous chapter, I was kind of waiting for the discussion of the kosher rules.
Yes.
And how they were derived, particularly since I'm doing a Gypsy chapter.
They're similar. Yes.
And
that is the kosher. The weird thing about the kosher rules, I suppose, is that sort of one of the most important ones is clearly does not follow from what it's supposed to follow from. That, as you may know, one of the kosher rules is you are not to eat meat products and milk products of the same meal. And how far you carry that is going to depend on how orthodox you are. I remember my father teasing my grandmother that she ought to have separate tables for milk and fleischlich. But it is the case... I'm not sure if some people have separate sets of plates, but they might. But it's certainly the case that there are rules about how many hours have to elapse between one and the other. turns out, as far as I can tell, that the only basis in Torah for this is that you are not to stew a kid in his mother's milk. So as far as I can tell, you could stew a kid in another cow's milk and you'd be home free as far as Torah is concerned. Let alone eating rabbit with milk or something, or, you know, some, or lamb with milk. You think would be all, yeah, I'm not sure if rabbit's still.
Is that a thing that you're not supposed to feed a human child?
No, no. It's a kid. It is a baby goat.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Got it.
Right. So the idea is you eat kid.
Yeah.
Kids, but you're not supposed to do this. But why? I don't know. I'm not an expert on the Bible. But that then, and this is one of the things that gets justified what they refer to as a fence around the Torah. And the theory sort of is, well, if this violates the rules, we won't even get anywhere close to it. Because, you know, you might violate it by accident. You might not know. You can just sort of imagine the way it expands. That, you know, we aren't going to let you stew a kid in any nanny goat's milk. Because how do you know for sure that it wasn't that it wasn't the mother of that? Well, you're not going to let you stew a kid in any kind of milk. Because how sure are you that it wasn't the nanny goat's milk? Well, we aren't going to let you stew any kind of meat in any kind of milk. Because it might be. And it sort of goes on from there. It seems very strange. And that does make one wonder if it's something where there was really a different function. And that goes back to the gypsy thing. The question is, to what can you plausibly interpret? I don't have an answer to the question. Various rules like this as really having the function of separating the one group from its outsider neighbors. So if you say, look, we're keeping kosher. I'd like to go over dinner to your house, but I can't. And could invite you over for dinner, but it would sort of be a little embarrassing, as it were. So you can certainly see that one possible effect of such rules is that. An entirely different explanation, which I mentioned in the course of the chapter, is that they're a test. That we want to know if you really believe in God, or really believe in Torah, or really believe in this particular religious system. Well, how do you find out if you really believe it? Are you willing to do things you'd rather not do or avoid doing things you'd like to do because the rules are forbidden? And you could imagine that eating fish on Friday for Catholics would have the same function. Why do we care? And that's where I think it's neat, because one of the things I discuss in the chapter is the system of oaths. That you have a system, and it shows up in, I think, at least two of the other systems I've looked at. You get a similar pattern in Somali law, and you get a similar pattern to some of the Plains Indian laws, where the basic pattern is that one piece of evidence of what you're saying is true is you're willing to swear a certain kind of oath that it's true. And at least some of the stuff, there's an implication that if you swear a false oath, you'll get divine punishment. One of the Plains Indians, I remember, was sort of, you're swearing by the heaven and the earth or something, and the implication is lightning. You'll die in the next year or so if you're not telling the truth, because the sky and earth will take care of you, kind of thing. And so, in Jewish law, you get this sequence of stages where basically, I have a claim against you, I claim you stole my cow, if I have really no evidence, no reason at all to believe it, you just say I didn't do it and you're home free. If I've got some reason, if I claim I saw you do it, but I've got no other witnesses, now you have to swear a binding oath that you didn't do it, and now you're home free. You are swear and are free. Swear and go free. If I've got somewhat better evidence, somebody else saw you do it, or got some other reason, but not quite proof, now I have to swear. Swear and take. So if I swear, you lose the case. And then, if I've got really good evidence, I don't have to swear either. And it looks, reading Maimonides at least, as though people are somewhat reluctant to swear. Even somewhat reluctant to swear when they're telling the truth, but presumably even more reluctant if they're lying. Not that they never will, of course, but that they're less likely to. So it becomes a sort of a lie detector. And you can see that for any legal system, having a lie detector is very useful. So one possible reading of these things, I don't know how this would fit into the Jewish, but I'm really just thinking of the Jewish age, so I looked at it in more detail, is that by following all of these rules, which is a good deal of trouble to follow, and not only in the sense of its cost, but you've got to pay attention to it. To do it, you demonstrate that you're a believer. Knowing you're a believer means they can trust you in a variety of other contexts. So that's sort of another possible way of reading some of this stuff. Yep?
I was wondering more about the oaths. and more like a, because the section that you have in here doesn't have any historical context on that. I was wondering, because it seems like a very specific, unique legal procedure that they kind of have put in place. I'm wondering if there's any evidence like when it was invented or for what reason, or
if you want, then what you could do is look at Mishnah, which is really the earliest source we have. And that's on reserve at the library, and there are chunks of it on the web. And Mishnah is, I think, about 200 AD or so. And that's, as far as I can tell, the first real compilation we've got that essentially, Torah obviously is much earlier than that. That's the Old Testament, part of the Old Testament. And it's clear that from Torah to Mishnah, you've got lots of activity by legal scholars and the Sanhedrin and various people making rules. Because Mishnah is citing all of that. The Mishnah is saying, you know, sage so-and-so argued such and such. And I don't remember, he probably such the Sanhedrin cases, I don't remember. But by the time of the Mishnah, you've got the division into the two schools of Hillel and Shammai, so that you will have cases in the Mishnah where the, pretty sure it's Mishnah, not Talmud, but things would say that Shammai argued this, Hillel argued this, Hillel decided Shammai was right and agreed, or the other way around, or they never agreed. That one of the things which you'll see when you actually read some of Mishnah, which I sort of point out, I don't know if any of you follow the link to my blog post about these three sources, which I'm sort of having some fun with just how confusing some of them are. Does anybody here know the story about the peasant who goes to the rabbi or the priest and he says, my hut is too crowded, what can I do? Because I'm taking off on that. So I have a sort of what I claim is the real version before they dug it down. The story is that the peasant goes to whoever the person to give him wise advice is, and the person says, do you have a cow? Yes, I have a cow. Put the cow in the hut. Week later, oh, it's terrible. You know, the cow did this, and my baby did this. No, it's just getting off. Do you have a goat? Yes, I have a goat. Put the goat in the hut. Week later, same story. Do you have any chickens? Chicken to the house, weekly here, comes back. Take the goat, the cow, and the chickens out. And he doesn't. Oh, Father, it's so wonderful how peaceful and quiet. I'm proud of the house. So I have a version of that, only in my version. He's been reading Maimonides and is complaining about how confusing it is. And so the rabbi tells him first to read Mishnah. And Mishnah is much more confusing because Mishnah consistently gives multiple answers to each question. Because it's trying to tell you, in effect, these are the opinions various authoritative people have. And I gather that there was a real scholarly dispute later as to whether the author of Mishnah signaled by how he put the thing which one he preferred. But at least it's not clear that you can read it and you'll see. And then you get Talmud, which is Mishnah plus commentary on Mishnah. Much longer, and the commentary is inconsistent with one person says, well, what Mishnah means here is this, and another, no, what it means is that, and so forth and so on. It really gets, it's really a thing. And so then I have the guy, you know, I have the peasant who's gone to the rabbi, he's saying, okay, you're learning Maimonides, he's told to read Mishnah, then he's told to read Talmud, then he goes back to Maimonides, and oh, Maimonides is so clear. There's this phrase in the tradition, from Moshe to Moshe was none like Moshe, where Maimonides is Moses, then Maimon. Hence, from Moses to Maimonides, there was none like him. Yes.
So, one of the issues that came up is the authorities, the sages, are narrowing certain rules, specifically you quote the issue of the pot in the street, and one argument is, well, that only applies when it's dark, and another argument is, well, it only applies when it's on the corner, otherwise you have to pay, and it's like, how do they justify this narrowing of the relatively straightforward text, saying if you leave a pot there and you break it, it's the guy who runs into it, it's the fault.
I don't know. I have not spent a lot of time on Talmud because I find it confusing and frustrating. I read some of it, and it's possible that what's going on is that this is playing off the fact that, for all I know, and I haven't gone back to check, Mishnah may give more than one answer too. Mishnah may say, this sage said that this happened. And so it may be that what's going on is that the commentator is trying to make the two versions in Mishnah consistent. He's trying to say, one of them said X, the other seemed to say Y, but he was really saying X except in some special circumstance. But that's just a guess. Yeah, no, one of the things I find puzzling in this whole thing is these are clearly people who take this stuff very seriously. They devote their life to studying it, and yet they seem to sort of my inexpert eye to be making to be reaching conclusions that no reasonable person would really believe were consistent with the original facts. But then, of course, how do you feel about the U.S. Supreme Court? All right. I mean, I like to say that the whole farm program is based on a case which held that a farmer growing crops to feed to his own animals was substantially engaged in interstate commerce. What?
Wickard.
Yeah, that's Wickard. That's right. And that's the case that the farm program was built on. And arguably, that's the case that half the things the federal government does. That's the case that marijuana illegalization is in some sense built on, because the claim when they have the case over having to do with medical marijuana, the question is, where does Congress get the right to regulate marijuana grown in California and consumed in California in consistency with California state law? And the argument was interstate commerce clause. Huh? That's interstate commerce. Well, if, after all, it's possible that the patients would have bought illegal marijuana from somewhere outside of California if they hadn't grown it themselves. And I don't remember all the details. I haven't actually read the case. But so a whole lot of what the federal government does is justified under this almost a screwy, it's not quite a screwy. And my usual claim is that by the standards of the rabbis, all American Supreme Court justices are strict constructionists, because they don't go as far, it seems to me. They don't turn stewing a kid in its mother's milk into you can't eat meat and milk within 4 hours of each other, whatever the rule is. But it's the same pattern, and that's part of what I find interesting about all this, why I've got one of my chapters about, you know, when God is the legislator, and it's a similar problem. You're stuck with something, so you always have to interpret the law, but the less easily you can change the law, because you're the incentive to have wild interpretations to get around what you don't like. For one of my favorite examples, let me read to you from, I'm pretty sure, Maimonides, the requirements for stoning a disobedient son. All right, I ought to actually have gotten a bit from the Torah, which says sort of, basically, if your son is disobedient and he gives lip to his mother and his father, they are to take him to the communal authorities and have him stoned to death. There's a little bit longer than that. He is not liable for stoning until he steals from his father and buys meat and wine at a cheap price. He must then eat it outside his father's domain, together with a group that are all empty and base. He must eat meat that is raw, but not entirely raw, cooked, but not entirely cooked, as is the practice of thieves. He must drink the wine as it is thinned as the alcoholics drink. He must eat a quantity of meat weighing 50 denarii in one sitting, and drink half a log of this wine at one time. According to the oral tradition, I'll get back to that in a minute, we learn that this law concerns a youth of 13 between the time he grew 2 pubic hairs and the time at which his entire male organ is surrounded by pubic hair. After the entire male organ is surrounded by pubic hair, he is considered independent and is not executed by stoning. If his father desires to convict him and his mother does not desire, or his mother desires and his father does not desire, he is not judged as a wayward and rebellious son. As implied by Deuteronomy 21:19, his father and mother shall take hold of him. If one of the parents has had his arm amputated, was lame, dumb, blind, or deaf, the son is not judged as a wayward and rebellious son. These concepts are derived as follows. His father and mother shall take hold of him. This excludes parents with amputated arms. What if he has one arm? And bring him out. This excludes the lame. They say, this excludes the dumb. This son of ours, this excludes the blind, because how do they know it's their son? He does not heed our voice, this excludes the dumb. Isn't it amazing? So you see why I think that the worst of the U.S. Supreme Court justices were strict interpretations. And where does this come from? I at some point I really ought to track it down more carefully. But basically what's going on, as best I recall, is that there is a rule which says that you're not supposed to have capital punishment unless the person has been warned in advance that what he's doing is a capital offense. And I think the way it's normal, I'm not sure if this is actually Torah or is rabbinic law, but early rabbinic law. It's one of the things that people are compromising away from later. And the normal thing seems to be that there have to be two people who, before he committed the offense, came to him and said, don't do that, because if you do, it's a capital offense. And he's got to have, in effect, said, to hell with it. So what the argument, if I remember that a good deal of this is is derived from, is that since stoning to death is a capital punishment, we can't do it to him unless he's been warned. And therefore, we have to find some part of the Old Testament which counts as warning. Now, why the part which says he gets stoned for doing this counts as warning, I don't know. But they then find some other part of the Old Testament which they say that's the warning, and therefore all the conditions in that part have to be met. And that, if I remember is correct, is where this stuff about the food that's not raw and not cooked and all the rest of it comes out of, because that's deduced, probably not very, probably loosely deduced, from the description of what it is that you're not supposed to do something. That's memory, but I really ought to set some point track it down. It's really quite a lot of fun to see if this stuff is done. But anyway, that's Maimonides, and Maimonides, as I say, is a very clear and author as this goes.
So you have another discussion later on about how it's really not possible for a conviction of a person who's dying from a terminal illness to take place, because the people...
Well, it's not even possible. All he has to do is commit the murder in court.
But otherwise, you can't do it because the witness against him wouldn't be afraid of... And I don't understand a lot.
The argument, it's really quite cute. The argument goes as follows, that killing somebody who is dying of an incurable disease is not murder. That's not an absurd claim. Maybe it's some other offense, but it's not murder. He died anyway. What is the reason why, if I testify that I saw you commit a murder, why does the court believe me? They believe me because there are penalties to me for testifying falsely. What is the penalty for testifying falsely in that case? It's that one of the ways in which you might argue that their system is superior to ours, perjury that leads to an execution is murder. Right, that's rather nice, right? I mean, there are cases you read where you feel that's a good rule, right? I mean, the cop who lied about it, the guy who faked the DNA testing, he ought to be tried for murder. All right? Well, but if I am testifying that someone who is dying of an incurable disease committed murder, even if I'm lying, I won't get punished, because after all, killing him isn't murder. Isn't that beautiful?
That's the logical leap. It's the punishment for testifying falsely against that person is in fact not murder anymore.
That's right.
But it would be if he weren't.
It would be if he weren't. Yes. Yes, I thought I made it clear, but maybe not. But, you know, what's going on here? And you know, in a sense, I assume, not having been a law school student, that you get some of the equivalent in the sense that you get hypotheticals, where the hypothetical is very implausible, but it's designed to sort of work out the logic of the system. There's sort of half a game. Am I wrong in assuming that happens in your courses, too? And so in that sense... you can see what he's doing, and it certainly makes for an entertaining and interesting little sort of logical exercise to think about how it works. But as I was struck by the idea that false testimony that leads to execution counts as murder, which strikes me as a not wholly unreasonable rule. It's one of the many places where sort of I read this stuff and I think, maybe we don't imitate that rule that somebody else came up with 2,000 years ago. And if we don't, as far as I know, perjury is just perjury. I don't know. Can you sue somebody for damages for perjury? Suppose your perjury results in my paying him $50,000 of damages. And it then turns out you were lying. And I can't recover the money from him.
I don't know what damage it is for you. It's a criminal case. And what you're talking about is a civil penalty. You can have some slander or some sort of civil
although injury. The distinction between civil and criminal, that's interesting. What would you say is the defining difference? Because if you look at these different systems, the lines are often very different. That in Sharia, as far as I can tell, murder is really a civil and not a criminal offense. And it sort of looks as though in Jewish law, theft is being treated as a civil, not a criminal offense. That maybe there's a criminal penalty as well, but at least what Maimonides is discussing are the rights, who has the right to what money or what objects when theft occurs, not, now maybe somewhere in there, I think I've read through all of the three volumes that correspond roughly to modern law, but only once, so I might have easily missed stuff. So tell me, what is it, if we're thinking not about American law in the 21st century, but law in general, especially Anglo-American common, but not just that, what defines something as civil and what is criminal? Why would we describe murder in one system as criminal or in another as civil?
One seems to be against
Yeah, the way I would put it is one is treated as. That is to say, it seems to me if somebody murders me, that's an offense against me. But that's not the way the law treats it. Or rather, it treats it only in the context of a tort suit for tortious loss of life, but not of a criminal suit. So the closest I can come, at least, is that one of them is treated as an offense against the state and one is an offense against a person. And I would have said that typically there are a bunch of implications of that. One of them is that a tort case, the victim can forgive the offender, in a criminal case, he can't. And there's this interesting comment in Blackstone, 18th century, sort of the famous treatise on common law in the 18th century, where he mentions that there exists a legal procedure, which by his time still exists on paper but isn't really very practical, for what's essentially a private criminal suit, with I think execution as a possible outcome. It's called an appeal of felony. And it's one where an individual, who I guess is in some sense a victim, I'm not sure of the details, is the one who initiates and conducts the case rather than the representative of the crown. And Blackstone says that if someone is convicted on an appeal of felony, the king cannot pardon him because the king wasn't a party to the suit. So that the implication, I think, if I'm understanding correctly, is that a criminal case, the crown can pardon because the crown is the one who theoretically was against, who was controlling it. A civil case, right, as far as I know, am I right in thinking that in U.S., that's an interesting question. In U.S. law, to what extent can either the executive or Congress cancel the result of a civil suit? I actually have a case in mind, but for a moment. I'm thinking... Well, the court, the judge can throw out jury award. That's not the same thing. I'm talking... That the judge and the jury are still part of the court system. What?
Yeah,
are
you saying the executive...
Or the, can Congress say the court ruled that you owe him $1,000 in damages, but we decided you don't? They can do it in advance because you've got cases of immunizing. For example, with vaccine, there's a vaccine case, a case which I think is an outrageous case on entirely other grounds, in which Merck, I think whoever was making the live polio vaccine, is sued by somebody who gets polio as a result of either him or his kid getting the vaccine. And the view of the court is that the live polio vaccine is unavoidably hazardous. This is before they had the current version of the polio vaccine. Hence, that giving it is not negligence. The question was whether there was adequate warning. And the company that makes the vaccine provided, they know that there's like a 1 in a million chance that you get polio from the vaccine. The company that makes it informs the doctors and nurses and people who are doing the immunization about this, but does not monitor them to make sure that they inform the patients. And the question is, was that negligence? And the court's position is, whether it's negligence depends on whether a reasonable person might decide not to get a vaccination versus this risk. They then make a mathematical mistake of about 20-fold and conclude that the answer is yes, but the answer is no. Because what they do is they compare the risk of getting polio from the vaccination with the annual risk of getting polio if you're not vaccinated. But of course, the vaccination protects you for your lifetime. So they should be comparing it to the lifetime risk. They find their two numbers are roughly the same. Hence, the right calculation is there's about a 20-fold difference between them, however you estimate how long it is. And they find the vaccine maker liable. All right. This is a case where I would argue that those judges clearly ought to be liable for punitive damages for killing thousands of people. We don't know if they killed thousands of people, but you figure that that made vaccines harder to get. But the eventual result is that Congress immunizes vaccine makers. Now, I don't think, maybe you know, I don't think they're immunizing them against past cases. I think what they're doing is saying, from now on, there is some, I don't know if there's no liability or some limit to your liability if people get something from your vaccine. Well, the ex post facto is criminal, isn't it? Well, I will let you, if you know people who, or maybe I'll ask some of my colleagues about exactly how this comes out. Because the case I was thinking of was that, as you may know, it's fairly clear that in the course of various anti-terrorist stuff, the phone companies released information to national security people, which under civil law they were bound not to release. And they were sued And Congress, I thought, ended up immunizing them. And that sounds as though they were being immunized for a tort they had already committed. That's why I was wondering what the status of that was. But at least if Blackstone is right, the king couldn't have done it. Yeah.
There's, I think, Congress can pass a law that can have power on an ongoing case. So if they had filed an appeal and it was waiting for the appeal, and then Congress changes the law, and if so long as the law is the right kind of law that reacts to a change in itself, then that can function. So it's probably some weird civil procedure trick that a lawyer used by filing an appeal and then lobbying Congress to change the law.
Well, I doubt it was a lawyer. I think it was the administration pretty obviously wanted to understand from their standpoint they didn't want the civil law to get in the way of whatever they were trying to investigate.
Well, you probably know this, but early in the United States history, up until like 1830, it was possible to hire a prosecutor for a criminal offense.
That's interesting.
You actually have to rely on what we now call the district attorney.
Do you know what were they prosecuted under the same set of rules as an ordinary prosecution?
I believe so, yeah.
All right, because the situation Blackstone describes, it really is a different legal case. That is a different part of the law that you're using. Because my understanding is that in England, it is still possible, I'm not sure if it's still an appeal of felony, but it is still possible for private parties to initiate a criminal prosecution. And there was, in fact, a very high-profile case, which has just come back into the news fairly recently, where a kid, I think it was black or Indian or something that people were prejudiced against, gets beaten to death by a gang of other teenagers or something. And I think the police declined to prosecute. I think the police decided they can't prove who was responsible or something. And if I remember correctly, I think his parents or his parents and other people initiated a criminal prosecution, failed to get a conviction. This was like 10 years ago, 15 years ago. And within the last few months, the case reappears. And if I understand what happened, at least I'm going by an ordinary news story, so I may have gotten it wrong, but it seemed to be saying that the English, the Parliament or somebody, removed the double jeopardy protection. So that the people were retried for the same thing they'd been tried for once, and this time at least one of them was convicted. So, I'm going by web news stories, so they don't necessarily get the law right. You could, I suppose, see that you might argue, well, he was tried the first time not under ordinary criminal law, but under this special case where private party can initiate it. So that doesn't free him. You could be even. Maybe that's what happened. Is maybe this news story had it wrong in claiming the law had changed.
I can't imagine why the situation was the way it was in the early United States with the lack of government and people on the frontier. You don't actually have a constitutional authority to be able to prosecute crimes. Crimes are so committed, it's like you hire someone if you got the money and say, here's the law, go sit down.
Yep. Well, as you'll see when we read the 18th century English stuff, that was the norm in the 18th century in England, that crimes were not prosecuted. The exceptions. Actually, now that I think about it, that was still true on paper in England until like 1860 or 1870. What happens, we'll get more of this later, what basically happens is in the 18th century system, pretty much the only crimes that were prosecuted by the Crown were crimes actually against the government. Robbing the treasury or something. That ordinary crimes were put as Rex v. so-and-so. So it was formally a criminal case. Prosecution is by the victim or the victim's agent. It can be by any Englishman. But in practice, it's usually by the victim or the victim's agent. But unlike a civil case, the result is not a damage payment to the victim, nor is it a result the victim can cancel. That the victim is doing the work, but he's doing it on behalf of Rex, on behalf of the Crown. And therefore, if, for example, you have one of the goals, you've got the pardoning pattern, and one of the ways you get pardoned is by agreeing to enlist in the army. Well, that means that the Crown is getting a payoff, in effect, in exchange for letting you go free.
I think that's a key difference between the civil and criminal system.
Is who can let you go.
The nature of the penalties.
And then I would have said that all of the nature of the penalty is a funny way of putting it, because the appeal of felony was in some sense civil, and yet you could be executed. And lots of criminal penalties are fines, after all. So I think it's not the nature of the penalty, The question is who controls them. That is, I would have said that what I think of, and I really got into this long before I did this from the law and econ standpoint, that the civil is a system where a private party, the victim, controls prosecution and owns the penalty. That the criminal is one where the state controls prosecution and owns the penalty. So that what we call a plea bargain in criminal, we call an out-of-court settlement in civil. And the out-of-court settlement requires the plaintiff's permission, whereas the plea bargain does not require the victim's permission. Might be prudent to get it. For PR reasons, it requires the permission of the public prosecutor. And what happens in England is that England, in the 18th century, also doesn't have a police force. They've got people called constables, but the constable doesn't really have the job of detecting crime. He's, in a sense, sort of an official who's got a... who does detect the crime has to get to do the formal stuff to arrest people and things. And the English police force originates in London about 1830. And one is Robert Peel. Bobby Peel is the one they call Peelers for that reason, so that invents it. And it's interesting, if you read the early stuff, like one of the early Peelers retires very rich, and there's strong suspicion that he's getting paid off by people in various ways. But one of the things that happens is that the police act as private prosecutors. So the police, once there are police, have evidence you've stolen, and since any Englishman, including an English policeman, can prosecute any crime, they include in what they're doing prosecuting you. So you have de facto public prosecution from the 1830s on, but it's something like 1860 or 1870 before you actually have public prosecutors in our sense in England. So I don't know exactly how the pattern was in America, but you can see that we start out modeling the English pattern and then gradually diverge from that. So that was sort of part of what was interesting about 18th century England, because one of the things that got me into this game was trying to make sense of old systems. So anyway, we've gone a fair distance, but going back to Jewish law, it looks as though a lot of stuff seems to be being treated as civil that we would treat as criminal, and I would have to look more carefully to figure out whether that means really both. Of course, in our system, a lot of offenses, as O.J. Simpson discovered, can be prosecuted both civilly and criminally, and sometimes different verdicts because you've got different standards of proof, different juries and such. Let me mention some other things that are related to this, because one of the things that I mentioned in the chapter but that intrigued me reading about Jewish law and in a different way about Islamic law is the impression of what I think of as sort of the remnants of a feud system that you then build over. Because one of the things that seems a little weird, but sort of seems less weird the more I think about it, is this business of in effect, letting the money lie where it falls. You think about sort of the simplest rule of tort is no one's ever liable. Right? The simplest rule of tort is your car got smashed, all right, you've got to fix it. That's got some real attractions, right? It saves us a whole lot of money on lawyers. Not attractive for you people because you're going to be lawyers. For the rest of the world. And if you imagine a world where you say, look, most of these torts really are accidents in a strong sense. Not only was it not on purpose, nothing you could have done to prevent it, it just sort of happened. And that's what you end up having, after all, in our system, in any part of tort that required negligence, if you weren't negligent, the loss lies where it falls. All right? And so the version of this that struck me in the Jewish law is that I have committed a tort against you, and it's unclear, it's on the border between two different categories of tort. One of the things which I discuss in the chapter is the goring ox, which is the first of the four categories of torts. And the rule for the goring ox is that the, you know what goring means? It means using his horns to injure another animal. That's the context. And the rule is that if the owner was not forewarned, not have reason to think his ox was dangerous, then he owes half the value of the other animal that was killed by his ox. Up to the value of his ox, oddly enough. And not above that for some reason. And it may just be because when the rule was originally evolving, you didn't have any way of seizing property for damages, but there was the ox you would seize for damages. I don't know if that's just a guess. But in any case, but if he is forewarned, which basically means that the ox is gored before, only goes into much more detail about how recently and how often and so forth, and there are various complications there. But if he is forewarned, he owes the full value of what's been damaged. Well, suppose it's not quite clear if he was forewarned. You think about it as like a U.S. criminal case where there's evidence but not beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not, and you need, or you need, this requires a rule that's not preponderance of the evidence for reasons we'll see in a minute. So the court says, well, maybe he owes the full value, but maybe he doesn't. We aren't sure enough he owes the full value or worth the full value. So all we'll do is make him pay after that. All right, straightforward. But now let's suppose that after your ox gored my animal, I, being angry and self-righteous, grabbed your ox and carried it away. I'm stronger and bigger than you are, and carried it away to my field. I have just appropriated your ox. Why have I appropriated your ox? I claim that you knew that was a dangerous ox, that you were forewarned, you owe the full value of my ox is at least as good as yours, the stealing on what you owe is the value of your ox, so I just confiscated your ox. The court won't make you give it back. And what's the logic of that? Well, the court also doesn't know to the necessary standard of proof that you didn't owe me a full ox. Right? Isn't that cute? There must be some criminal, the closest criminal example I came to is the one I have in the chapter, which is where you are sure that one of two people committed a crime, you don't know which, and you've got to let them both go. But I'm sure with a little more ingenuity, you can think of some case in our law where the equivalent of that happens, where you're, I guess the obvious case, I suppose, is suppose there's a piece of property, an object, and there is some real doubt about who it belongs to. Well, it looks as though if I've got it, the court won't maybe give it to you, and if you've got it, the court won't make you give it to me. Possession is 9 points of the law. So I guess that would maybe I should put that in, because that would be the closer analogy. But then, you think a minute, why does the law assume that you might have taken the ox? Why does the law assume that the victim of an offense might have, in effect, forcibly compensated himself? And I should say, this isn't only tort. The same issue arises in contract. When the contract is ambiguous, when the contract says I owe you 100, but I forgot to say which kind of coin is 100 of. And so I lent you money, and one of us claims that it was 100 of this, and one of them claims 100 of that. And we, and the court can't tell. And again, the result seems to be that if you haven't paid back the debt, that the court will only make you pay the lower of the two possible figures. But if I grabbed from you an amount representing the higher of the two figures, the court will make you do that. So that sounds an awful lot, as though they're starting with a system where people are assumed to enforce their rights themselves, and are then modifying it for a system which is enforced. That's my theory. I can't prove it, and someday I'll find someone who knows more about this with Tomi's complete bunk, but it struck me as an interesting way, an interesting plausible guess about what's going on. And you then get a different version of the same story when you look at murder law. Because one of the things going on with murder law is this odd stuff about the Avenger of Blood and the city's refuge. And that apparently, back when the king of Israel was a going concern there, how far back I don't know, but at least when Torah was written, I guess, or a little after that, you had cities of refuge. You had certain cities which had a special legal status. And the legal status was basically sanctuary. It was basically that those were places, I think, where somebody who committed an offense could run to and couldn't be dragged out. Just like you get something similar with somewhere in the temple where people can take sanctuary under some circumstances. You get, I think, in medieval Europe, churches are sanctuaries. You get sort of symbolical, some of the people who were sympathetic to illegal immigrants want to declare their city to be a sanctuary. It doesn't have any legal force, but they can say, we at least won't arrest you and we'll do our best to protect you if the feds come for you and so forth. So it's an idea that shows up in a variety of different places. But in any case, what you end up with by the time we actually have Jewish law functioning is that you've committed a murder, and what you're supposed to do is to first you run to one of the cities of refuge. And why are you doing that? And I think the presumption is because the son or brother of the guy who you murdered is going to come after you. And if you don't get the city of refuge, you're out of luck. And you get to the city of refuge. Then you get escorted to the city where the crime occurred to be tried. You're tried. I think what happens is that if they conclude that you committed murder under circumstances that make it a capital offense, and you have to go through my Maimonides to get the details of when it is or isn't, but there's a whole range, as you can imagine, between accidental death and first degree murder, so some parts of that range is a capital offense. Now, if I've got it right, say a measure of blood was supposed to execute the person who would have had the duty of avenging his father or brother in a viewed system prior to this other system. I think that's what happened. But now, suppose they acquit you. Suppose they say, all right, you did indeed commit a crime, but it wasn't capital murder. Wasn't murder one or the equivalent. Now, a couple of learned sorts, I think a Vlachy scholar, are supposed to escort you back to the city of refuge. And your penalty is that you're stuck in the city of refuge until the high priest dies. Sort of an arbitrary term, but that's the rule. You're not supposed to go kill the high priest to get out, because then you've got another crime like this. That seems to be true. However, if the avenger of blood catches you before you get back to the city of refuge, he pushes these two old learned men aside, takes out his sword, kills you, he's home free. Right. I think, I may be wrong, but I think from reading Maimonides' account that that in theory is the law. And then, of course, the bizarre thing about it is that Maimonides is going into all of this detail at a point where there has been no city of refuge and no high priest for more than 1,000 years. I don't know. I probably no high priest. There's no temple for 1,000 years.
But it will come back.
Well, that's what I don't know. I can't figure out whether Maimonides honestly believes, right? I mean, it seems odd, but a lot of people believe things that don't seem to make very much sense to other people. Whether Maimonides honestly believes that one of these days, you know, the Messiah is going to show up, we're going to get Israel back, and of course we will reestablish the law. And if I am teaching people the law, it would be irresponsible not to teach them what the law is going, was, and will be. The once and future law, as it were, when we get Israel back. So that's one reading of it. A second reading is he's an academic, he's a completist, and he says, look, it's not for me to decide which parts, I decide what the law is, but it's not for me to decide which parts matter. I'm going to try to give the whole thing, this whole body of stuff. And I'm sure if you think about education in a lot of other fields, that there are fields where even though certain things are a dead letter now, probably even in the law to some extent. I think about Blackstone discussing the appeal of felony. You say, well, it's sort of part of the intellectual project is to show you the whole picture, and maybe you'll see the way things go together. Maybe you'll understand the current law and the old law better. Or who knows what's going on?
On the common law, we've been back and forth with the commerce clause, which has gone back and forth 3 different times in terms of the court's attitude towards what the Congress can and cannot do. And it's like here we are now in 2000 with Lopez and the Drake decision, but it's like it used to be different back in 1930, and it was different back in Locke, and it was different back in 1960.
There is, by the way, a book defending Lochner now, which you may want to read. It's out of the future. I've won the whole sympathetic to Lochner. Lauren Kerr's book, that's right. And I've seen a good deal of references to it, and it sounds as though the sort of, I don't know, as everybody knows about Lochner, it's sort of the demon case that people always cite, at least according to Kerr. Most of what came out is true if you actually know the case. But that's a separate issue. What is true, apparently, is that the Lochner court declined to follow out the same logic in cases where we would be much more sympathetic. Because there was one of the things why when I read an article, because sometimes it's sort of interesting, was that in the, I guess it would be about 1900-ish, there were people in the business of finding blacks in the South in places where they were very badly off and putting them together with employers also in the South in places where they were treated better and when there was a shortage of labor and so forth, and arranging to transport them and only getting some kind of, I don't know if the employer paid them a fee or something. And the various states shut them down. The various southern states, in effect, regulated this business out of existence. And it ended up in the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court let them do it. And at least the argument of the article I read was the same principles of Lochner ought to have said that just as the state can't control the hours of working of bakers, the state also can't forbid a perfectly legal and ordinary transaction. And it didn't. So that's sort of an interesting case. So it's not an attack on Lochner, but it's an attack on the Lochner court. When you discuss this stuff, by the way, do you discuss the only successful example of court packing of the Supreme Court in U.S. history? Do people know what president packed the Supreme Court?
Was
No, Roosevelt threatened to and didn't. Who did it? Lincoln. Lincoln appointed the then chief judge of the California Supreme Court to be the 10th justice on the Supreme Court in, I think, 1864.
Well, but there's a reason for that. There's a reason for
that. Well, the reason for that was that he was a pro-war Democrat.
No, it's more than that. Back in the days when Lincoln appointed this guy, I know it was something. The Supreme Court was organized by circuits, and literally they appointed a justice from every single circuit in the United States. And California, when it came into existence as a state, is now part of this new 10th circuit. And logically, there had to be, therefore, a Supreme Court justice from the 10th Circuit. And he periodically went back to California, right in the circuit, as all the other Supreme Court justices did during this time, and settled cases, and including a ridiculous case in which he ended up presiding over the trial over the former Chief Justice of California, who then tried to murder him and was killed by his own Secret Service detail in a case that then went to the Supreme Court as to whether the U.S. government was allowed to protect Supreme Court justices when they're out on circuit. The Supreme Court was
you realize that the same gentleman also tried to run for president. He didn't get the nomination.
I didn't know that.
Arguably, he's the man who won Loeffner. He was dead at the time.
Yeah,
he was the longest-serving Supreme Court justice until fairly recently. Interesting character. He was part of the he was California Gold Rush character. And I'm trying to remember the name because I'm also blocking on it. But I wrote a review of a biography of his, which I called Earl Warren in a White Hat, because the review was in a libertarian publication in Liberty Magazine. And my point was that he did exactly what the conservatives accused Earl Warren of doing. Namely, first he decides what the Constitution ought to say, and then he looks for excuses to claim it says it. The only difference was he was doing it on what at least the libertarian on the whole would have seen as the right side rather than the wrong side, hence Earl Warren. But I'll remember Stevens?
Stephen Beard? No.
You'll find him. You can find him online. But anyway, very interesting character. But basically, by Loeffner, he was dead. But his nephew, I think, was on the Supreme Court at that point. And the Loeffner decision was really the result of the way in which he had been pushing constitutional law for literally decades. Stephen Field. That's it. And if you come across his biography, he's really quite a lot of fun. He's an interesting character. I didn't remember the part you were telling, but he did try to get nominated for president at one point. And he's somewhere, there's a quote from him which comes very close to saying, if the Constitution doesn't say this, it damn well wants to. And one has some sympathy for it. No, he doesn't carry it too far. I don't think he actually goes so far as to say that forbidding women to be lawyers is unconstitutional. That was one of the things that he comes down on with the majority on the wrong side. But he does say that forbidding, he's in the minority in the slaughterhouse cases, so he's arguing the state does not have that authority. I believe he's in the minority or majority on the question of whether a state can forbid somebody to be a priest if that somebody was a Confederate. But there are various post-Civil War things where they're in effect trying to lift various of the rights of people who had been rebels, and I think he's against it. Anyway, Stephen Field, interesting character, worth reading about. Not about Jewish law, still interesting. A lot of interesting stuff. A bunch of stuff that I don't discuss and ought to go over my notes more carefully, add to it at some point, are the various ways in which transfer happens in Jewish law. Because you've again got some interesting sort of artificial ways of doing things, where you have, I think the initial rule is that when I pay you to buy something, as soon as you receive the money, something becomes mine. But then there are later points rules saying I have to take possession. And then you have various issues of how you handle commerce where I can't take possession of something either because it's not available, it's not here at the moment, because it doesn't exist yet. So that my monetary solution to contracting for future things is I can't have ownership of the calf that hasn't been born yet. But you can swear an irrevocable oath that you will transfer it to me after it's born. And then that's how you get around that. But one of the interesting bits is that when you and again, I really have to go over this more carefully to be sure I get it right, but at some point in the law, you aren't supposed to be able to transfer things you can't physically hold over, hand over. But an exception is if you transfer land, anything associated with the land goes with it. And there's no sharp definition of associated with it. So the theory is that I want to transfer some goods that are on a caravan 400 miles from here. So I say, well, those goods are associated with this little square foot of land, which I'm now transferring to you, and now you've got those goods. What if I have no land? Well, that's all right. Because every Jew is entitled to a per capita share of the land of Israel, which unfortunately is being occupied at the moment by the Ottoman Empire or possibly the Fatimid Caliphate or wherever it's got it at the moment. So therefore, I can transfer my share of the land of Israel along with this property. So you get all sorts of weird things. You've got another one, which is a sign again. I really ought to understand it well enough to give a really consistent account of those things change over time. But you've got the idea that barter, once one half of the barter has been taken account, has been taken possession of, the other half now automatically falls. So I give you a handkerchief, and in exchange for the caravan off there, I probably also give you some money, but the handkerchief does it, and now that's mine. The handkerchief theoretically is yours, and you give it back, and she don't really need it. So anyway, a lot of weird stuff going on. You know, I think the chapter could be three times as long. In fact, there's this three-volume book by Menachem Elon, which was my main source after I came up on other less good sources. And then there's Maimonides itself, which you could write quite a long chapter just by getting more of Maimonides' answers. I don't know how many of them are his, by the way. In some ways, I discuss a few of the things in Maimonides that I liked as an economist. The Journal of Political Economy used to, and for all I know still does, have on its back page sort of quotations of odd things that economists will think are neat. And I thought of sending into them a couple of chunks of Maimonides because he had, one of the questions is tort damages for injury. And he has, I think, five categories of loss. There is the damage to you, there is the pain and suffering, there is the humiliation, there is the medical cost, and I think there's the cost in time if you're being disabled for some length of time. And he then explains how to calculate each of them. And how do we calculate how much you owe me because you, in some tortious fashion, cut off my hand? Well, let's just consider the fact I don't have a hand anymore. That's only, we're going to have all five categories. We take that one. What do you owe me for the fact that I no longer have a hand? How do we figure this out? Right. Somali law and Sharia, well, Sharia in particular is the clear one. Sharia, the answer is, we first figure out how much you would owe my heirs if you had killed me. We then say, all right, I have two hands, you wiped out one of them, you owe half that amount. The Sharia is one of these things which has got the virtue of giving you a pretty clean answer to a bunch of questions, but it's not a very sensible answer. Because, for example, if you cut off my nose, you owe me the full amount, because you only have one nose. Cut off a finger, you owe me a tenth. So, cutting off a hand and cutting off a leg is the same effect in terms of the damage of it. But that's not, that Maimonides is much more sensible and sophisticated than that. Maimonides' answer is, you say, suppose somebody like me were a slave, because we got slavery existence, what would his market value be? How much less would his market value be without a hand? That's the market estimate of the value of a hand. Okay. It's not perfect because, of course, people were slaves aren't identical. Maybe I was a skilled worker or something. But nonetheless, if you try to think of where do we have sort of an objective measure of the value of the cost of losing a hand, there it is. Well, he says, how about the pain? Ah, he says, the question we have to answer is, suppose you've been condemned to lose your hand by the king for some offense. And we've got two alternatives. One of them, we can cut it off with a sword, which is what this tort feature does. And the other is, we can give you opium or some other drug that will essentially anesthetize you and then do surgery under those circumstances. How much more would you pay? How much would you pay to have it under surgery rather than, or may I have to pay or be paid to do it the other way? That's the revealed preference, subjective preference, just the stuff economists like, to you of the pain and suffering. Now he sees the logic of it, all right? One of the implications is that the pain and suffering damages to a rich man will be higher than to a poor man. Because the rich man would value it more money. Furthermore, the pain and suffering damages to a man who is very sensitive and really hates pain will be larger than to a tough, thick-skinned guy who, you know, is a boxer or something, gets beat up every day for fun. Well, the second one sort of feels more just to most of us than the first. And Maimonides doesn't, at least he doesn't seem to be worried by it. It seems as though he's just saying, well, you know, this is the logic of the system. This is how you figure out here's the answer. So I thought that was really quite neat. That one of the interesting things reading historical stuff is seeing how many of the sort of moral judgments that seem obvious to us don't agree with people. I had sort of a very different case. I've written a couple of novels, one of which was commercially published but not very successful, one of which I published in the Kindle, and the second one was a fantasy. And one of the things I sort of did in the background was that one of these main secondary characters is the daughter of a very important nobleman. And she gets treated better than other people. And they're both college students at this point. I never say that. It's just that if you're paying attention, you'll notice that the protagonist, who's her best friend and a college student, has one room in the dorm, which is presumably bed, desk, and everything else, whereas this one has a sitting room and a bedroom. I don't explain why. But it just seems to me that a lot of society just take it for granted that important people get treated better. And, you know, if you ask why, it's not clear whether it's because, well, she's important, or whether it's because, well, her daddy is an important guy, we hope he'll give us money at some point in the future, or we'll hope he'll pressure the king to give me a pension when I retire. But a lot of the stuff that we would think of as somehow corrupt or unfair just doesn't occur to me. Have any of you read the Aubrey Maturin books? These are historical novels set during the Napoleonic War. One of them was made, or several of them were combined into a movie. That's right. Which is the title of one of the books, but I think it's not actually from that book. It's parts of several. They're very good historical novels, and they give you a very good feel for the society. And one of the things that I thought was really neat is there's a passage. One of the protagonists is a ship surgeon, sort of philosopher, scholar, bunch of other things. Interesting character. The other one is the captain, who's his best friend, and on his ship he sails as a surgeon. And one of the captain's officers is a young man of noble birth, the son of a count or a duke or something, and he's a lieutenant. And he goes to Maturin, the surgeon. He says, "You know, sir, I've got a question. I'd like your opinion on." And he explains that he has been having an affair with the estranged wife of the secretary of the navy, the top naval civil servant. And the question is whether they should go public, whether he should openly live with his mistress or not. And Maturin says, well, you know, I'm not going to come over you with, you know, as a moral authority or anything, but if you consider from a purely practical standpoint the dangers to your career as a naval officer who's not yet a captain of offending such a powerful person. And he says, well, yes, sir, I have thought about that. But my family commands 18 seats in the Commons on a division and 4 in the Lords, and I think our influence is sufficient to balance it. All right. What we would think of as political corruption, he just takes for granted. That, of course, if I offend this guy outright, he'd get me. But on the other hand, I got political leverage. I'm an important person, or my relatives are important people, and therefore they can promote my career. And there's no implication that anybody in this exchange sees anything wrong with any of this. And so that was really neat, sort of in terms of giving you a feeling for roughly late 18th century way of looking at the world, at least among that set of people. And that's part of what I like. There's a older set of historical novels with the same setting by C.S. Forrester, the Hornblower books that some of you may have read. And reading them, the difference is that the protagonist of the Hornblower books differs from his contemporaries in being more like us. He is upset about flogging sort of sailors, for example. The contemporary, the two protagonists of the Aubrey Maturin books differ from us in being plausible late 18th, early 19th century types. And in that sense, it's just a better book. And I should say, one of the Aubrey Maturin books has on its back the endorsement I want if I ever write a historical novel. And what it says is, C.S. Forrester has given enormous pleasure to many people, myself among. These books are so much better that it's almost unfair to compare them. Signed, Mary Renault, who was one of the top historical novelists in the 20th century, writing about Greek stuff, not about this stuff. And that's the endorsement I want if I ever write a historical novel, which is not likely. What? Yeah, it really is. And she's very good if you've read Renault stuff. But in fact, when you're reading Athenian stuff, if you want some light reading at the same time, read some of the Mary Renault novels, because she pretty clearly identified with classical Greek. Again, she was sort of, in some ways, she feels as though she's more a classical Greek than a modern English and eventually South African character. She was also gay, by the way, which became relevant, actually, if you look at her biography. That her first novel was about homosexuality in England in the 20s or 30s or something, before she gets on. And, of course, one of the features of Greek, of classical Greek culture that she's identifying with, although homosexuality there is usually male, not female, but clearly she's very comfortable with that and sort of seems natural enough to her. She wrote a very good three-volume book on Alexander, on which the third volume starts at his death. It's called Funeral Games. It's basically about the fight over dividing up the empire among his generals after he dies. But the first two are about him, and she clearly is very much an admirer of Alexander. And the second one, the viewpoint character is a male, I don't know how you would describe it, basically a homosexual concubine of the Persian emperor who then becomes one of Alexander's after Alexander overthrows the Persian Empire. And it was a positive, I mean, he's a eunuch, I should say, not a, so male in some sense, but he's a, again, a positive, interesting character. So Mary Renault is very good. And again, that's not irrelevant to this course in a sense, because what she's doing is giving you a picture of a very different society, legal system, and all. But anyway, so other things people wanted to say, talk about with regard to Jewish law. We'll be talking about Jewish law more, of course, next week. We'll be back to get some of the primary sources. But did you have particular points that struck you? Yeah?
Just a question on the charismatic leader and yes. What role that plays.
Yes. That's the Furnace of Otnai. I don't know. I think I have a link to a longer version of the Furnace of Otnai story, which is a really neat story because you're not sure which side you should be on. Because here you've got this guy who is, as I read the story, he's probably the top living legal scholar. That at least one of the leading people of the other group was his student. That's made explicit. And at the point when the scholars have decided to ban Eleazar, I think what's going on, though I'm not sure, is that Eleazar is not only making his argument, he is judging cases according to his interpretation of the law. And I think that's why he's getting banned, though it's not entirely explicit. And when they ban him, the guy who was his student disciple says, let me tell him. Because if the wrong person was to tell him, it would be the ending of the world. And you don't know quite what that means. But somehow they're playing with dynamite somehow. They're not quite sure how. Because after all, God's already come down on the laser side in this story, right? God has spoken out of the heavens and said in all matters of halakha, Rabbi Eleazar is right. And they chose to divide that. To not accept that judgment. It's a really neat story. And a weird story. And so one way of reading it, and the way which seems to be not implausible, is to say, if the ultimate basis of your law is what God said, how about if someone shows up nowadays who claims he's got a direct line to God? Well, how do people do that? Well, people do that. Right? You think about the people who found sects nowadays. What they do, they convincingly claim to have a direct line to God, and they persuade people, some people. And I've got a footnote which I've got to fill out because I've got to find the source. But there's if you look at medieval Islamic sources, there's a fairly prominent figure, I think Shia, but I'm not sure, who, according to who you believe, is either a con man or a saint. And one of the people I read describes how he does his tricks. But he does things like providing fresh fruit in the litter. And there's some explanation of how the guy basically says, I spotted this trick and I ran for my life, essentially. And the guy is eventually executed by the caliph or something. But sort of up to the last minute, it's not clear if he's going to be, because if he really is a saint, what's going to happen to you if you execute him? So you can see that in the system, you're going to worry about that situation. You're going to say, what if somebody can convince people that he's got a direct line to God? Well, one answer is to say, sorry, buddy, that doesn't count. God gave us the job of interpreting the law, even if it's true. And that's, in a sense, part of the Forensic Machinai story, which I think you've got to believe it is true as they tell that story. Even if God comes and speaks out of the heaven and says he's right, that's very nice. Glad to hear it, God. But you are no longer the one deciding the law. You gave us the job. Fact. And that's at least how I read the first half before the catastrophes start happening or almost happening.
Is there not a policy decision behind it to prevent false prophets.
That's one, I think, plausible way of reading what's going on.
Well, one thing you see in religions almost to a very common feature is that the latest guy will come along and say, I am the last prophet ever. And so my word is not to be contradicted by future prophets.
Yes. Well, if you take a look at Islam, if they do it, it doesn't entirely work. That is, the official doctrine in Islam, certainly the official Sunni doctrine, is that Muhammad was the last of the sealed prophets. There are other prophets. Moses was a prophet. Muhammad considered himself being in the line of the Jewish prophet, but that's it. But then you look at the Shia tradition, and the Shia take the position that the descendants of Muhammad through his daughter, the Fatimids, basically, are that one in each generation is divinely inspired. And that one is the one who really should have inherited the caliphate, but the damn Sunni stole it from us, essentially. And since he didn't inherit the caliphate, he is the religious leader. He's the pope, even if not the emperor, as it were, is the way they affect their divide. And that goes on according to which Shia group you look at for either, I think it's either 11 or 7 generations. And the different Shia factions disagree about who these people were, about which ones. But they are thought of as religious authorities like the prophet, and therefore the tradition of what they did is legally binding in the same sense as the hadith of the prophet. And you even get, a good deal later in Africa somewhere, a Berber Quran. You get somebody who announces that his grandfather was an inspired prophet and wrote his own sort of second edition of the Quran, and for a while has his own Muslim heresy going. Anyway, Dr. Boyd, something.